and welcome to Worlds Apart. The expression reality check entered the geopolitical vocabulary from the field of psychiatry, and it still carries some of its maddening ambiguity. What's reality to one nation is a total distortion to another or a complete horror to a third. Is the international system still capable of sane and respectful conversation about what's actually going on in the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hal Gardner, Professor Emeritus at the Department of History and Politics at the American University of Paris. Professor Gardner, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, throughout your academic career, you wrote a number of books dealing with various patterns of international politics, including imperial ambitions or the dynamics of war. And as much as I can tell, I think yours is a pretty mature look, without excessive sentiment, without virtue signaling. I think it's a conscientious effort to assess reality in the best way possible and offer some modest, responsible solutions of how to improve it, or at least make it a little bit better. Now, do you think such an approach, historically informed, conscientious, rational, unsentimental, do you think it's actually in demand today?
I would like to believe it's in demand. I would argue that the whole social media issue and the way the media is turned now is really devastating to real fact-checking and understanding what's going on. But the real problem is we lack a global vision. And almost all my books predicted this horrible war going on between Russia and Ukraine today, starting in 1994 with Surviving the Millennium and then Dangerous Crossroads in 97. Those books contain pretty much what's happening at the moment because I based it on historical analysis and close observation to how the states are actually interacting, not what the politicians were saying they were saying.
Well, Professor Gardner, but let me interject here, because you sort of put the blame a little bit on social media. And the reason I'm asking this question is because I see, as a media professional, I see a huge gap between the academic field of international relations, which has an extensive knowledge about the dynamics of conflict, the precursors, and, you know, conditions that are necessary for a lasting settlement, and the actual reality of international politics, when pretty much none of this knowledge ever gets applied. And let me mention that this knowledge is hard won. It is blood soaked, and it is responsibility not of the media professionals but of politicians to avail of that. Why do you think they are not doing that?
Yeah, I wasn't blaming the media in itself. I mean, we go back to the Vietnam War. The media was blamed for losing the war. That was total baloney. It was the Chinese who were protecting the North Vietnamese, and the U.S. didn't want to go into North Vietnam. I mean, there's other reasons besides the media that are preventing these conflicts from resolving themselves. So a close examination of what's really happening is what the academic world tries to do. But when you present it to policymakers, they're hit by all directions, from special interest groups to their own personal ambitions, and end up making decisions that are very often contrary to those of their own advisors. Mm-hmm. So this, you're absolutely right that there's a real gap between those of us who have been trying to argue for a rational policy towards Russia and China, but yet are really brushed aside for immediate political considerations.
You wrote in one of your articles that the longer the Russian-Ukraine or Israel-Hamas-Iran wars persist, the more the global system will polarize between states that are pro-US or pro-West and those that are pro-Russia and pro-China. And I think this is exactly what the West is pushing for, perhaps due to its nostalgic memories of the Cold War and how it ended. I think there is a perception in the West that they can prevail in this bifurcation, but I'm not sure that either Russia or China are going there. Aren't they actually trying to resist as much as they can this new bifurcation of the world that the West is pressing for?
I'm saying that that's the reality that is being pushed, and that's why I'm saying that the U.S. needs to engage with Russia and particularly with China right now and really reorient American strategy towards both countries in order to bring this escalation of tensions bring it down and begin to resolve the numerous crises that we're facing. And both wars, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Palestine, and China, Taiwan, which could break out at any time, are expanding the conflicts rather than finding ways to resolve them. So U.S. needs a totally new strategy, starting with hopefully the Harris administration, if that comes about.
I think you can only change your way of relating to others when you change your view of yourself. And that leads me to my next question, because this logic of my way or the highway, or you know, you are either with us or against us, works only for the dominant power. And it's not a choice. It's a blackmail target. And the West has had reasonable success applying it over the last couple of decades. But I wonder if the West is trying to execute it again, trying to drive this hard bargain because of its perception of power, because it believes that it can do it to other nations, drive them the way they, you know, it wants them to go? Or do you think it's because perhaps of insecurity and not knowing anything better?
That's a very good point. I think it's a little bit of both. If you put the BRICS together now, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, plus others that are joining, their economies are actually much greater than the group of seven, the group of seven most industrialized countries. So on the one hand, there's a bit of insecurity, fears of insecurity on the Western side, the U.S., European, Japanese, et cetera, the G7, versus this new, what they perceive as a new Euro-Asian axis arising economically. And they're fighting to contain that movement, mm-hmm. and assert, maintain the global hegemony. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly the problem here. If the more you do that, the more both sides react and expand the conflict. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you really need to start engaging with both sides rather than trying to confront them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the word containment and this idea of double or triple containment of restraining, right. Russia, China, and, a whole number of other dissenting countries.
Iran, North Korea.
Yeah, yeah. It's very popular in the West, but it's hard for me to understand what's the point of it, at least from the Moscow's perspective, because Russia doesn't want to spread its influence indefinitely. It doesn't want to be, you know, the next global police cop, but it will not compromise on its national interests, and neither will China or any other, you know, self-respecting nation. So what is the United States trying to contain when it pursues its policies of containment?
The case of China and Taiwan, U.S. is concerned that China's urge to unify with Taiwan, one, they don't, U.S. doesn't feel that is absolutely necessary, but their fear is if China acquires Taiwan, then they control the sea lines of communication and the shipping routes from Asia, Japan.
Okay, and then what?
And then that's just the fear. Then China dominates the region, and that undermines U.S. hegemony. So that's the problem there. And therefore, I propose a compromise in which a confederal system, Taiwan, China work together, confederally backed by the international community. Mm-hmm. And this would be a totally different way to approach the whole region. It would help solve some of the tensions between the Philippines, mm-hmm. and China over the South China Sea and other things like that. So, mm-hmm. so there's ways to compromise here if both sides are willing to compromise. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm seeing China, because China is becoming the major peer competitor, as the Americans put it. We have to work with China primarily. Before this war, I would have said we work with Russia. But now the Russian whole idea of working with Russia, bringing Russia into a new Eastern European security order, European security order, It failed, or the U.S. didn't pursue that as the early Bush senior administration tried.
Well, I think one thing in common between both the U.S.-Russia and U.S.-China challenges is, again, this either you're with us or against us dynamic. Either you are, you know, a winner or a loser. And I think both Russia and China see the world in a somewhat different way. And if we put them aside, most governments around the world right now are facing serious domestic challenges, having to adapt to a fast-changing world and to respond to the, you know, sometimes conflicting needs of their people. Why would they be interested in limiting their options and choosing the United States over China or the other way around? Why would anyone be interested in partaking in somebody else's war instead of, you know, minding their own interests?
Well, this is why I'm trying to say a compromise is possible. International, bringing in what we used to be called contact groups, working at each conflict, China, Taiwan, Israel, Palestine, Iran, Russia, Ukraine. We bring in international community, not American domination, international groupings in which the regional states themselves take over their security concerns and begin to develop the region. So it's a win-win situation, in my view, getting the U.S. working with China, working with Russia, working with Ukraine, working with Taiwan, working with Iran and Israel, finding ways to calm these tensions down and beginning to develop each region.
What you have laid out here is already happening all around the world. It's happening in Eurasia, where regional countries with many diverse interests and sometimes open conflicts come together to manage their regional affairs. The same happens in Africa. We can see similar development in Latin America. But there's one major obstacle here, and it is the West, that for some reason would not allow this consensual approach, win-win, genuine win-win, to take root. And it keeps sabotaging it by sparking conflicts around the world or picking up battles with other great powers. What can possibly pacify the United States? What can possibly make Western elites believe that they will also have their due place in the world? They will retain their influence, but it will not be the dominating and often very destructive influence that they have enjoyed over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, this is the problem. Every empire goes down pretty hard, and then they collapse. Some of them collapse rather rapidly. So the issue here is, how do we find compromises between the so-called vital interests? Now we have to redefine what is considered vital. For me, pushing NATO into all the way up to Ukraine was not vital. That this was not a vital American interest. The U.S. could have, with the Europeans and with the Russians, developed a whole new system of European security had they worked on it from 1991 on, but they didn't. Same thing with China, Taiwan. There's other ways to manage China-Taiwanese relations, a confederal approach as opposed to a one-China approach. The problem is, when you are a hegemonic power, you don't want to give up on your hegemony. I agree. But the problem is, well, also, you end up losing out big time if you don't start compromising earlier. And this is the root of traditional conservatism, not the neoconservatism and not the kind of conservatism that Trump talks about.
Absolutely. I want to add here, if I may, that you lose not only in terms of your weight in the international arena, but you also lose domestically. You lose in the eyes of your own population. And then you are faced with the situation when the country is highly polarized and the choice of candidates, not very inspiring, the choice of candidates for the next presidency. Yeah. Professor Gardner, let's take a very short break right now, but we will be back to the discussion in a few minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Hal Gardner, Professor Emeritus at the Department of History and Politics at the American University of Paris. Professor Gardner, in one of your articles, you stress that it is absolutely crucial to put an end to the Israel-Hamas war in order to prevent it spreading regionally and perhaps even globally. And I think we would all agree on that, but what makes you hopeful? What makes you believe that it is possible at this point of time?
Well, I think there is demand inside Israel to get rid of Netanyahu, and two, to put an end to this war, and they want the hostages back. So some of them are dying or have died just in the whole process of trying to eradicate Hamas, which is not going to be possible. And in the process of doing so, Israel is militarizing the entire Middle East. I understood the Houthis have been able to recruit tremendously in their battle in the Red Sea, and other groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS are thriving. We just had a few attacks here in France. But listen to this, you know, Ofer Bronstein, the advisor of Yitzhak Rabin, just came on just a few weeks ago, stated that Israel should immediately recognize a Palestinian state. It should have been done years ago. But Yitzhak Rabin tried, but was assassinated by a Jewish extremist. So his advisor now is saying it's time to bring back the same approach, creating a Palestinian state. That would limit the ability of Iran and other states to assist Hamas. It would be a non-militarized state, but it would give the Palestinians some respect. They would get a support from the Arab community and begin to build themselves with the help of not just the Arabs, but the international community. But Israel's being impacted by really a neo-imperialist viewpoint, political drive, which is destructive not only to the Palestinians, but ultimately destructive for Israel itself.
Now, can I push you a little bit here and run by you what I often hear here in Moscow from Russian Middle East experts, and they have pretty deep-rooted connections in the region too. And they tend to believe that, you know, this Israel-centric approach, suggestions that Washington has to put pressure on Israel and then the problem will resolve itself, they believe that it in itself is a little bit, imperialistic, because if you actually look at the founding documents of many Palestinian organizations, from the PLO to Hamas, they are not ready to found a state next to Israel. They are not ready to abandon all the territories that were under, you know, sort of the Palestinian control during the British mandate. And none of them would agree to that. And the idea here, the suggestion that I hear all the time is that, you know, there's some sort of fantasy in the Western world that once Western leaders grace any particular problem with their royal attention and put pressure on their satellites, that somehow the problem resolves itself. But don't they actually have to talk to the Palestinians too? And it seems that the Palestinians at this point of time are not ready to compromise because they want their land back. And this is not something that either Israel or the United States are willing to offer.
Right. Well, on that point, it's very interesting. When Vice President Biden went to Israel once, Netanyahu purposely announced the expansion of settlements into the West Bank to undermine American pressure on Israel. So there's a push-pull relationship here between Israel and the United States. And Americans have let the Israelis, literally now getting away with murder in Gaza. Absolutely. There has to be negotiations with Hamas at some point and with Fatah. So many mistakes were made over the years and the inability to find an accord. They came very close. The Tabo Accords a number of years ago came close, but then they were overthrown. And then Ariel Sharon unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, and that created a new diamond. He didn't do it. He did it unilaterally. He didn't work with the Palestinians in arranging a new state as he did his unilateral withdrawal. And that ultimately allowed Hamas to come to power. And so these, obviously, the Palestinians are frustrated, but it also they have to deal with the real circumstances. So that's where they need international support, lots of money, and start redeveloping the region, and then hopefully finding these some of the finding resolving some of the issues that they that you're rightly you know they're not going to get all their land back, but what can compromise with that?
You mentioned before your vision of a Palestinian confederation, which could be backed by foreign or Arab financial assistance with international peacekeeping forces on the border with Israel. And you argued that such a Palestinian confederation would help reduce Iranian leverage on Hamas and other actors, and perhaps even set the stage for a new Iran nuclear accord. Now, that seems like the best of both worlds, but the skeptic in me wonders what would make the Palestinians and the Iranians believe that this offer, this intention of peace is genuine, that it is for real, and that it is not yet another ploy to buy time and disadvantage them long term.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. You know, every time in the two Iraq wars, for example, when the United States got the world community to attack, first the 1990 war against Saddam Hussein and the second one in 2003, which was not approved by the UN, they both said, we're going to solve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis after we get rid of Saddam Hussein. What's happened? They didn't solve any Palestinian crisis. So the legitimate skepticism about all U.S. proposals. And that's why it can't be just the U.S. I know the Russians have been, a number of Arab commentators have urged Russia to intervene. I think China has offered to intervene. That's why it has to be a joint effort, what I call contact groups, working U.S., Russia, China, in this case, might be able to make a convincing case to the Palestinians and the Iranians that peace is possible. But if it's only going to be the Americans have lost their image of the honest broker, if they have ever really had one. And that's where I agree with you. But as I said, the more states you bring into this, and the regional states too, Jordan, Egypt as well, Russia, China, then you begin to create a international pressure to try to really resolve the issue. And that's the only way it's going to happen. Otherwise, believe me, it's going to continue to expand and accusation against accusation.
Well, at least it could set a precedent for a genuine peace mediation, which I think is in such a desperate demand today. The world really needs to at least one conflict to be resolved in a genuine manner. And I want to turn our attention now to the one that is much closer to my home, the one in Ukraine. And I think the same problem that we discussed, not just the lack of trust, but rather the presence of very strong and very legitimate mistrust, I think it plagues the Ukrainian conflict as well. And unlike in the case with Gaza, with Ukraine, the West doesn't even recognize that Russia has been actively trying to be a constructive partner. To this very moment, it relates to the weapons that it is using in the Ukrainian conflict, to the targets selected. Russia does signal to the West that it is amenable to, equal, respectful, wide-ranging negotiations. But I think the ante is being purposefully upped on the Ukrainian side and fully supported by the West, which at this point doesn't even know what it's actually pursuing in that war. How do you see this collision, the collision of these two worldviews being resolved?
Well, I think there were chances back in 2022. Where the Turks certainly came up with a resolution for the cereal crisis and getting cereal grain. And I really, from what I understand, the Brits and the Americans really put a check on the continuation of the negotiations, even though Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, looked like he was going to go along with them. So there was something there that had nothing to do with resolving the situation, the crisis. There was something that was purely geopolitical, in which the Americans and the Brits in particular wanted to continue the conflict. So that created a lack of trust in the ability to resolve this conflict that has continued to this moment. Okay. I purposely think we're moving into a new period where if Russian forces seize Pokrovsk, if I can pronounce it correctly, and Ukrainians are able to maintain some of the territorial advantages that they've taken, which they might not be able to do in Kursk, you might be able to come to some sort of agreement at this point. But right now, without a, what you can call a mutually hurting stalemate, where both sides feel that they can't move forward without undermining their own interests, you won't get a settlement to this conflict.
But Professor Gardner, this is a very interesting point, because in order to achieve that mutually hurting stalemate, you need to have a certain accounting of your resources. And when it comes to Russia, I think Russia's goals or objectives are more or less defined. Russia has the resources to achieve it. They are not overwhelming. Sure, it's bleeding, it's hurting, but you know, there is some relationship between what we are trying to achieve and the resources that we have. The same is absolutely absent on the Ukrainian side, because the Ukrainian side, first of all, doesn't even know what it's realistically trying to achieve. And then it has to rely on the outside actors for the very basic war fighting necessities. So I wonder if the mutually hurting stalemate, as you put it, is even possible at this point without, you know, some genuine accounting of what you have and what you're trying to get to.
You know, it's very uneven. It's not clear. You can get it mutual. Both sides define their hurt in totally different ways. So they may not agree on this as a mutually hurting stalemate. But I would simply step back and say, look, Russia is becoming pretty dependent economically on China. And in my view, this is another reason why Russia should think closely about continuing this war, if it means creating too great of a dependency on Chinese investments, finance, dual-use technology, et cetera. And its only market now for energy pretty much is China. And China's raised up its interest rates, et cetera.
Well, I totally agree with you that Russia has strong incentives to put an end to that war. And I think it's not shy to recognize that it wants it to be closed. But in order for that to happen, there has to be some agreement with the Ukrainians and with the Americans about the security arrangement in this part of Europe.
Yeah, certainly. I totally agree with you. And that's where I've tried anyway to outline a sketch, a few possibilities where you have a deal where Russia will probably get some of the territories that is taken in the Donbas region and maintain the Crimea, which I think is most essential. At the same time, Ukraine will regain some of its territory, but then you're going to have population exchanges and all sorts of issues that will
absolutely. But what do you think would satisfy the Western appetites to really genuinely strive for the resolution of this war?
Well, that's where I'm afraid that they only react to force. And in my view, the way this war will go, Putin's not going to attack NATO countries, but the war could expand in new regions. And this is what concerns me the most, that the more this war continues, it's fairly limited in its region now, Ukraine and Russia, but it could easily expand to Transnistria in Europe or even North South Korea. Those are the in my view, the two areas that could explode at any time if this war continues. So it means reason in Washington, reasonable people in Washington, and hopefully a new reasonable administration next year will see that this war is going to get out of control, and it's in nobody's interest for that to happen, and therefore begin to wind it down, working with China and Russia to do so.
Well, Professor Gardner, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. It was great.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.